good to go?
Okay. Hey, I call this meeting to order. This is the Senate State Affairs Committee. Today's date is March 15th, 2011. The time is 9:03 in the morning. With us today, we have Senator Kukesh, Senator Pasvan, Senator Geisel, Senator Meyer, myself, Wilikowski. We have two bills before us, Senate Bill 98, which concerns the collection of biometric information, and Senate Bill 89, which proposes revisions to the state ethics laws. First bill we'll take up is Senate Bill 98. I am the prime sponsor of this bill and have eight co-sponsors in the Senate, including Senators Coghill, Ellis, Menard, McGuire, Geisel, Egan, Pasvan, and Thomas. The bill is similar to the one I introduced last session, which the legislature ran out of time to fully consider. It protects Alaskans from inappropriate use of their fingerprints, retinal patterns, voice patterns, facial characteristics, and other biometric information. We have a CS for the bill. It is version M. Do I have a motion to adopt this version for discussion purposes?
Sure, Mr. Chair. I would move that we bring the CS for Senate Bill 89 version /M before this committee.
Okay, and I'll object for discussion purposes. Here to present the bill on my behalf is Michael Caulfield. He's an intern in my office who has passed the only bill in the legislature thus far. So we're hoping he goes two for two.
Let's hope so.
Michael, welcome to the committee. If you could put yourself on the record and give us an overview of the bill. And then if you could, after you're done, give us go through the changes in the CS.
All right. Thank you. For the record, my name is Michael Caulfield. I'm an intern in Senator Wilikowski's office. I'd like to thank the chairman and the entire State Affairs Committee for allowing me to present this bill today. As the chair mentioned, this committee substitute just adopted is a close resubmission to the Senate Bill 190, which passed through both the Senate State Affairs and the Judiciary Committees last year, and I will explain the changes at the end of my presentation. The purpose of Senate Bill 98 is to update a law that is already on the books to protect our privacy rights from emerging new technologies. Senate Bill 217, introduced by Senator Donnie Olson and passed unanimously by both bodies of the legislature in 2004, outlaws the collection, analysis, or storage of a law-abiding person's genetic information, or DNA, without their written consent. Of course, advances in DNA technology have already proven to be of a great benefit to society in a variety of fields, such as law enforcement and medicine. Yet DNA science also holds a potential for misuse, in particular to obtain information about people that they have a right to keep private, such as a genetic predisposition towards disease. It was a wise decision the legislature made in 2004 to protect the people's right to keep their DNA information private if they choose to do so. Once again, however, emerging technologies threaten our privacy rights. DNA is only one form of what has become known as biometric information, physiological characteristics that are entirely unique to an individual that can be used to obtain information about people that they have a right to keep private. One example of the potential misuse of biometric information is through the use of facial recognition technology. Through facial recognition technology, an individual can be tracked anywhere they go without their knowledge. Another more commonly known form of biometric information is the fingerprint. To attest to the potential misuse for these, we have an Alaskan on the off-net who will be able to provide his own story. Senate Bill 98 will ensure that no organization or person takes biometric information from another without their consent. It allows for the use of other identification in place, such as a passport or state ID card. Of course, we realize the incredible usefulness that biometric information can have when used in law enforcement, so we have exceptions for those purposes. Additionally, there are exceptions for when biometric information is obtained while authorized by state or federal law. Finally, the bill does not ban the consensual contribution of biometric information, which can be used in numerous fields like medicine. The bill does provide for private rights of action if biometric information were to be taken illegally. There are few things Alaskans cherish more than our privacy. In fact, the right to privacy is famously written into our Constitution. On the most basic level, this should include a right to not have our biometric information, our fingerprints, handprints, face scans, etc., collected and disseminated to third parties. Senate Bill 98 has broad support from Alaskans, as seen in your packet. Additionally, Jason Giamo, the man who brought this issue to our attention, Jeffrey Mittman of the ACLU, and Horst Poperal, CEO of Borealis Broadband, are online to give testimony. Thank you, and I'm here to answer any questions you may have.
All right, thank you, Michael. And let me just recognize that Senator Coghill is here, and he's been here since we started the hearing. Are there questions to the sponsor? Okay, seeing none, let's, can you describe the changes between the initial bill and the CS?
Yes, you'll see this, it's in your packet, it's right after the work draft and the sectional analysis. On page 1, line 13, the and after United States passport has been changed to or. That's because many Alaskans don't have passports, and it would be unfair to require a passport and an ID for the many Alaskans that don't have passports. On page 2, lines 18 and 21, the term biometric information has been added at the beginning of the sentences just to clarify that we're talking about biometric information. Page 2, line 22 through 25, we added exemptions to be more clear that the Department of Administration and the DMV would not be breaking any laws by taking pictures for ID cards. And then we also added facial images that are not used in a biometric system that protects us from someone like grandma taking photos at a, you know, barbecue or something from being prosecuted as tracking people. And then on page 2, line 30, just a couple more types of biometric information were added. That includes finger geometry recognition. And then on page 30, line 1, we removed the word palm from palm vein recognition because there have been new types of vein recognition that have come out that include maybe the wrist. And we want to make sure that we cover all veins instead of just the ones on your palm. And that's it.
Thank you. And I'll just say there are a number of different things that this tries to get at. And I think one of the things that has been a concern to many Alaskans is the idea that what we see in Great Britain, for instance, where there are literally cameras everywhere, and they watch you, and they know exactly where you are. And I think most Alaskans just instinctively don't like that. And that's one concern. We'll have some testimony about some of the other concerns that have been raised. Any questions? Okay, yes, Senator Pastor.
This is more as a technical. In the vein recognition definition on page 4, lines 1 and 2, should the word palm print, in other words, it seems to limit it only to palm prints?
Mm-hmm. Yes, I do see that now, and yeah, we'll definitely go fix that.
Yeah, I think
that would be, could be misleading.
Okay, thank you. Online. Okay, we're going to take a brief at ease around some technical difficulties. Technical difficulties this morning. We can't tell who's online, but we think we have some idea. Is Jason Jaimo online? Jason, are you there? Okay, I'm not hearing anything. Jeff Mittman. Jeff, are you there? Okay, is anyone online?
Jason Jaimo's here.
Oh, Jason, you are there. Great. If you could put yourself on the record and give us your testimony.
Jason Jaimo?
Jason, if I could ask you to speak a little closer or a little bit louder.
Okay.
Okay, there you go. Perfect.
I had brought this to the attention about 2.5 years ago to Senator Ellis, Wilikowski, and Myers. They've been very, very helpful in addressing or working to help me address this issue on a statewide basis. I'd like to say first that data mining and biometrics collection is big business. The International Biometrics Group estimates that the industry revenues will exceed $7.5 billion for 2012 alone. Corporate revenues from fingerprints, iris, vein scanning, and facial recognition surveillance make up about 49% of that total. Well, data broker ChoicePoint is now owned by the European conglomerate Reed Elsevier, sells to 7,000 private and government customers, according to their own website. The U.S. Department of Homeland Security is the primary buyer of the information that they collect. I wanted to stress that this is not actually about the CPA exam. This is a far bigger, more important thing. This is about protecting all Alaskans' privacy in an environment that's increasingly hostile towards privacy protection. What started out as a good bill last session with SB 190 is now an urgent bill this session because of the remarkably rapid deterioration in the privacy environment over the last 12 months. Things that are going on that I would never even predict. For example, the Schumer-Graham bill that's proposed in Washington right now, the cornerstone, I'm not sure if the committee is aware, the cornerstone of their immigration reform proposal that's being considered right now by President Obama is a mandatory fingerprinting of America for a biometric worker's ID card. These kinds of things, 2 years ago or a year and a half ago, I never thought would be even proposed. But now not only is it proposed, it's being proposed by two of the key senators from the East Coast and been given some serious consideration. This is what takes an issue that only affected a few thousand Alaskans last year and makes it an urgent issue that would affect every senator, every House of Representatives members, their wives, their families, their kids. Anybody who wants to work at a Subway sandwich shop would need to enroll them their fingerprints in the federal ID card program under the Chuck Schumer Act. So the way that I got brought into this was about 2.5 years ago. I went to do the last two parts of the CPA exam for the state of Alaska. After a five-year-long struggle with many, many thousands of dollars spent and time, and you know, anybody who's passed the bar or the CPA exam or any similar very, very difficult exams knows the commitment and sacrifice, not just mine, but my whole family sacrifice to get to the point where they can actually sit and pass the test. So I had spent about 5 years doing all the classes at APU and everything else to get to the point. And I passed actually the first two parts of the exam. It's a four-part exam. And I went to take the third and fourth part over a two-day period. The problem was that the calendar had clicked over to January 2008. The security policy had changed. So when I went in to take that, they said, well, we need your fingerprints in order to allow you to sit down and at the computer to take your test. I said, well, that's new. What's that all about? And they said, well, it's just for identification, just to make sure you are who you say you are. I said, well, that's certainly a reasonable request. So here's my U.S. passport. Here's my driver's license. Here's my Social Security card. You know, I can go home and get my birth certificate if you need. What else do you need to substantiate my identity? And they said, well, even though you've never been fingerprinted before, which is true, I've never been fingerprinted for any reason, we need your fingerprints for identification. Your passport is not sufficient ID to take the test. Now, this is not a background check. This is just to take the test, just fingerprints as ID. So I refused, and it was by far the toughest thing I've ever done, to walk away after that kind of a commitment and time and everything, an emotional commitment, and you know, thousands of dollars spent and 5 years of my life pursuing this. I walked away because I figured it was better to retain my integrity than to get a degree or CPA license. And that's where it stands now. I've been refused to enter the exam room because my U.S. passport is not sufficient ID, according to the new rules. I'm also a certified internal auditor, so what I do is I follow the money trail, which led me to the obvious question is why is this nonsensical policy in place? And it turns out that the people collecting the information, the company called Prometric Corporation, it's a global company. They have offices in Spinard. UAF is under contract to Prometric, so UAF is performing services for them as well, collecting fingerprints. Prometric collects the fingerprints, and they receive a fee for doing so. And then on the back end, they transfer the fingerprints to an international data mining company called ChoicePoint. ChoicePoint, I think, is pretty well known on the Hill. They've received the largest fine in the history of the Federal Trade Commission for misleading privacy statements and just bad privacy policies. However, this same company is being entrusted to hold all of the CPA's fingerprints. So really, in the end, it's about money. And this is a really distasteful policy. It's certainly not what it seems. It's not for identification. like they say. And this is something that it's not just the CPA exam. It's many other exams require fingerprints as ID, and it's just a very disturbing trend. There's a city council in Arizona which is trying to pass a city ordinance where anyone who wants to receive their medicine at the local pharmacy needs to be fingerprinted in order to do so. So if you don't agree with being fingerprinted, then you can't get your medicine. You know, this kind of thing is very disturbing. The head of the superintendent of the Los Angeles Unified School District, Cortinez, is seriously considering a mandatory fingerprinting of all low-income school children where they'll be denied subsidized school lunches. These sort of things are, I think, mostly pushed by the biometrics industry lobby. Like I said, biometrics is big business, and I've seen a letter already that Senator Welikowski received over the summer from one of the biometrics industry lobbyists, Security Industry Association lobby. Anything that protects Alaskans' privacy will hurt their ability to collect and traffic our personal data. So I urge the State Affairs Committee to approve this, and this is good legislation. We Alaskans certainly need it.
Jason, thank you for your testimony. Are there any questions? And I'll just note for the record, you have been dogged in your pursuit of this legislation, and I want to thank you for that. Questions for Jason? Okay, seeing none. Anyone else online?
Yeah, I'm online. My name is Horst Popperell.
Please put yourself on the record and give us your testimony.
Hi, my name is Horst Popperell. I'm the CEO of Borealis Broadband. I'd like to thank you for the opportunity to voice my support for the bill restricting the taking of biometrics without consent. I am very much in support of this bill, and I hope the Alaska legislature doesn't stop there either. In today's world, we face an onslaught of public and private sector organizations that are determined to extract every piece of personal information possible, from your shopping preferences to biometric data. The intrusions into our personal and private lives are relentless. As a person with over 20 years in the IT industry, I can tell you with certainty that this situation has not only gotten out of hand, but it is becoming more and more dangerous for the average citizen. The more personal data that is collected and digitized, the more an individual is at risk for its misuse. Companies buy and sell this data to just about anybody who will pay the money, not to mention the number of times this information is just plain lost or stolen. I've personally been notified that my private information has been lost by two banks, a retail outlet, and the state of Alaska in just the last 5 years. We need to put a stop to this. We need to fire the first shot across the bow and say enough is enough. I think this bill is a good first step, and I encourage the Senate and legislature to follow through with additional legislation that further protects our private information from this kind of rampant abuse. Just like I tell my clients, the best defense is not to give up the information in the first place. And I appreciate you guys listening to my testimony.
Horace, thank you for your testimony. I'm seeing no questions. We next have Skip Cook signed up to testify. Oh, sorry. That's the other bill. Anyone else online wanting to testify?
We do have
a letter. Okay, hearing that, we do have a letter from the ACLU, Jeff Mittman. Anyone else in the room wanting to testify? Okay, seeing none, we'll close public testimony. Any further discussion on the bill? We're going to hold the bill over if there is none. And committee members have amendments or suggestions, then if you could please get them to my staff by 1 p.m. tomorrow, that would be appreciated. If you need more time, then please just let us know. Okay, we're going to set aside Senate Bill 98 and move on to Senate Bill 89, which is the sponsored by Senator Coghill. The bill proposes amendments to statutes governing legislative ethics. It is the product of discussions held by the Select Committee on Legislative Ethics over the past couple of years. We have a committee substitute before us. It is version D. Do I have a motion to adopt version D for discussion purposes?
And Mr. Chair, I move that we bring the CS for Senate Bill 89 version / D before this committee.
Okay, thank you, and I'll object to that motion for the purposes of discussion. Senator Coghill, welcome to the committee, and Reneva. If you could put yourself on the record and give us an overview of the bill. It's a pretty lengthy bill. And if you could give us a quick overview, and then if we could walk through the bill, and just so we understand, I know you, Senator Coghill, you and I spent a little time going through the bill section by section. That'd probably be helpful for the committee as well.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, I'm Senator John Coghill, District F, and with me is Reneva Moss, Chief of Staff, who I will ask to go through the sectional to give you the section-by-section look at the bill. And what I'll do is I'll introduce why we begin to look at the ethics bill. This has been a product, as you said, Mr. Chairman, of many years of conversation on a variety of different issues. And the reason I picked it up is when I was in the House, during the time that everybody was thinking about changing our ethics laws because of things that were going on in the legislature at that time. I was the rules chairman. At that time, probably 9 bills were introduced to change the ethics law. And I managed to get the people to agree to fold the issues together into an omnibus bill. And Representative Gruberg and I became the managers of that particular piece of legislation. So it fell my lot after that to be put on the Ethics Committee and get involved in several of the discussions that have been very difficult to answer. Some of the issues in this bill have been proposed now, I think, the third year running. And for a variety of different reasons, the legislation hasn't gotten to the finish line. I don't know that it was necessarily against the issues in this. But one of them became a politically hot issue. If you remember correctly, last year we had in here an issue dealing with the value of meals, and that snagged the whole bill to a dead stop, so that's not in here. So the two questions that I will probably address more passionately than anything else, because they have been the topic of discussion so much. One probably less than the other. The one that is the less discussed is the mailing list issues that have come to question. Can a legislator bring their campaign mailing list with them to work in the legislature, and can they take their mailing list with them from the legislature to their campaign? And there is an actual opinion on that was given by the Ethics Committee some time ago, and that is brought to this statute for codification. So that'll be one discussion. The other discussion is on state travel. When a person is, when any one of us are in Alaska as a legislator getting paid to travel around Alaska, when is it proper, if ever, to do campaign activity? And right now the statutes have a strict prohibition on anything that is actually political. Is what it amounts to, because that's how the opinions have come down. Anything that is partisan in nature, if you do it while you're on state travel, right now there's a strict prohibition against it. And I don't know that that's entirely an ethical answer. I think the ethical question really should be, what action should you be doing that is unethical in that partisan activity? The fact is, we as politicians generally are in the nature of partisan activity, whether it's here in this building asking people questions right across the committee room, or visiting in the hallway. Quite often the partisan part of our life is described by the label we wear, whether it's independent, Democrat, or Republican, or just a philosophy we carry, or a particular issue that we feel very strongly about. You can get relegated to a partisan. Well, when you go home in your travel arena, you don't change that set of clothes. So we have to figure out rules that allow us to be what we are, but not misuse it. For example, in my mind, it's always unethical to to use state travel to go back home and then get involved in some fundraising activity that benefits your campaign. To me, that's always unethical. If you're going to go home for a fundraiser, then do it on your own dime. But if, for example, I'm traveling to Fairbanks on state travel, I have a series of meetings in Fairbanks, and I have a meeting in Glen Allen. I drive to Glen Allen, but I'm asked to speak at a Republican luncheon on Delta on the way back. Under the law we have right now, that would be strictly prohibited. I would have to fly all the way back to Juneau, fly all the way back there on my own expense, go to Delta and speak at that luncheon. So the rules, in my view, the rules actually create a conundrum for us on when we're traveling throughout Alaska, because Senator Kukesh, your district is so large that you could do a state issue in one section of your district and on your way home do something that is related to your chairmanship of your Native corporation, and then be in another town and speak on a certain partisan issue. If you're doing that on state travel, that would be strictly prohibited. And I think with the ethical question to us is, when is it right for us as human beings to be partisan and do it on state travel? That's a conundrum. So some people would say never. But what that does is that kind of ignores the geography problem of Alaska. And that's where we're different probably than any other state. And in the packet that I've given you, you have what other states have done on this. But almost every other state in the union is connected by roads. Even Hawaii, you can drive to anywhere except for you have to fly to the different islands. So Hawaii is probably the closest place that we have with this conundrum. But you can literally take a day and a half to travel somewhere in Alaska. And I think the president of the Senate has talked, if you look at the minutes, many, many times on the Ethics Committee, that when he goes to his home in Kodiak, it takes sometimes a day and a half, sometimes 2 days, depending on weather, to travel there. And for him to go and be a part of a rocket launch issue, and then to go to his home and not be able to speak to a Lincoln Day dinner or be a part of some political event there, other than flying all the way back to Juneau and then flying all the way back so he could be a part of that. The law actually puts us in a tough place of being a good representative there. So what I tried to do is I tried to think, when is it absolutely unethical and when there's a reasonable discussion on using state travel, that the primary purpose is for state travel. And you're going to find in this section of law, I tried to put it as clear as I could, and we'll get to that when Reneva goes through that. The other question that came up with, many times we do state travel for a variety of different issues like NCSL, Council of State Governments, the Energy Council. And many times I think people in the Senate have gone out of the United States, China, and into Europe to represent Alaska on a variety of different things. Sometimes the costs don't come back in the 30-day window that we have allowed under our statute. So we expanded that out to 60 days so that the tallying of the cost and getting the information back from those who may have been sponsors of that trip can get that information to you. And also that was something that the President of the Senate brought to our attention. Some of the other issues that are more housekeeping and have been discussions from the ethics training that we've gotten, and my own office is deeply involved in this, was when you are helping somebody in your office with government institutions, whether it's child need of aid law, which we do a lot of in our office, helping them with navigating through a very complex and somewhat arcane system, or workers' compensation issues, or permanent fund issues, or on a variety of different issues you might deal with, when can you honestly say, here is the limit of what we'll do for staff time? And we worked with somebody on a workers' comp case some years ago that we finally got to the point where It came so close to legal representation that we got our hands slapped saying, no, you can't do that. And so we thought it'd be good for us to describe that in the statute. When can you go to the degree of helping them, but you're not actually becoming their lawyer, you know, where they should really go out and hire counsel? And so we said that before, and just to give you the backdrop to that, for years, we were the ombudsman. The ombudsman was defunded in Alaska, so legislators were kind of the ombudsman. Now we have an ombudsman's office. But even before that, we did not have administrative law judge. We did not have an administrative law judge in Alaska. And many legislators had to push right up to commissioner level to get answers to questions, whether it was on property issues, on land sale issues, on a whole range of things. But now they have an administrative law judge. If there's a contest with an individual from the state and an agency, an administrative law judge, whether it's worker comp or land issues, a variety of different issues. So what we have now is you can help them right up until the time they get before somebody who is the final decision maker. And it could be the administrative law judge. It could be the contest of the commissioner. You can help them up to that point, and then you have to tell them you have to go through that decision process. And I think that gives us kind of clear boundaries on how far we can help somebody as a legislator in our district, and when is it improper for us to help them and hand them off to somebody who might be professional in that arena. It gives one exception, and that is for those of us in the legislature who are lawyers and who actually will get paid to do that. It allows that action to happen, but it has to be clear. So the other thing that happens quite frequently is the Legislative Ethics Committee will be considering a matter, and there you might not have a regular member of the committee being able to sit on a meeting, so they put the alternate in. And it's been in the past where an alternate could sit in for that meeting, and then when the regular member came on, they moved out, but they had to start asking the questions all over again and had to go through all the confidential information. We're saying if you start off as an alternate, and you start off in that hearing, you complete that whole hearing to its conclusion. If it's an ethics question on one of the members or an ethical question that needs confidentiality, that once you sit in on that, then you sit through that whole thing, regardless of whether the regular member can be seated or not. That alternate, once they're seated, will go all the way through. We also have codified in here that when a legislator cannot show up to the meeting, that the presiding officer can appoint somebody to show up. And that has happened where both the alternate and the regular member couldn't show up. That is an open question, I think, that has to be answered, and we get to be the body that answers it. So most of these questions have come up in a series of ethical questions that the Ethics Committee has had to ponder over the years. So I should have put this Bill 89, Senate Bill 89, by request. But it is a compilation of those questions. So, Mr. Chairman, with that, that is kind of the reason I got involved in it. That's kind of the big policy call questions. Now I'd ask, if Mr. Chairman, if you would allow Reneva just to go right through the sectional to show where these questions come up in the bill.
Great. Yeah, thank you, Senator Coghill, and welcome to the committee, Reneva.
Thank you. For the record, Reneva Moss, legislative aide to Senator Coghill. I have included in your packets a sectional with red writing, and the reason I did this is I wanted you to see where the Ethics Committee was involved in the composition of this piece of legislation. It lists by section advisory opinions and areas where the committee has requested that we include sections within this piece of legislation. Section 1 actually is some cleanup from legislation that was passed back in 2008 when a legislator was told that a staffer could not donate her kidney because that would be a violation of the ethics law. So in a 30-day period from the date it was introduced to the date the governor signed it, a piece of legislation was passed that accommodated compassionate gifts. So Section 1 is just adding some verbiage to existing statute to accommodate the passage of that piece of legislation.
If we
section
could just pause for 1 second so everyone knows. If you want to follow along with the colored version you're talking about, it's in this booklet that's been provided.
And each member should have a copy of the book.
And it's in the section called sectional.
Right. Also in Section 1, it deals with the issue of the mailing lists, and it deals with it in two different locations. One, the use of public funds and facilities, and then in the second place on page 4, it deals with using legislative mailing lists for fundraising or campaigning purposes. Section 2 is the section that Senator Coghill was talking about as far as representing or doing constituent work, and at what point do you let them loose and say, now you're on your own, you're within the area of an administrative hearing, and unless a legislator is a lawyer, that office would have to back up and the constituent would have to find legal counsel. There is an exception also for violation of this section if for some reason a legislative staffer or a legislator has been contacted ex parte unaware. As soon as they become aware of it, they must notify the Ethics Committee and the other parties concerned. And, of course, if a legislator or a staffer is called to testify before an administrative hearing, that would be an exception also. Sections 3 and 4 are the sections that actually deal with what Senator Coghill was discussing about travel time and partisan activities. And we tried to be as specific as we possibly could. This is, of course, legislation in progress, so this is a policy issue that the legislature will have to decide. But what we came up with with this piece of legislation is that you couldn't participate in partisan activities during a normal working day, which we're calling from 8 to 5, excluding a meal break. You couldn't participate in partisan activities on a state or municipal election day. Couldn't participate 30 days immediately preceding an election, and this is if you're on state travel. And in no conditions could you fundraise for a political party or a campaign. And that's the same qualification under Section 3 and Section 4.
Let me just pause right there. What is the current law regarding the executive branch on this? Do you know?
The governor, Mr. Chairman, I believe there has been a whole series of challenges and opinions by the Attorney General, but I'm not sure what the current one is. I think it is prorated, if I remember correctly.
Mr. Chairman, I think what they do is they prorate it based on de minimis use. And in the Ethics Committee, we tried to make that work in our law, but because of a strict prohibition in our law, for the legislators, and our reporting system is quite different. Quite frankly, our campaigning is quite different.
Section 5 is a section that was requested by the Ethics Committee. Under current statute, they are required to compile a list of statements that they receive for close economic association or loans through state programs. They have to basically establish a registry and keep it current. This would say what they must do is they must keep on file for public access all the disclosures that are filed, and they have to supply them to the presiding officers of each body of the legislature.
So if I understand, I'm looking at page 7.
Correct.
And looks like the current law is promptly compile a list of the statements indicating the loans and programs and amounts and send it, and you're changing that to maintain the disclosure as a public record. So are you broadening it then?
Mr. Chairman, we're not broadening it. They already have to maintain the disclosures. This just releases them from the burden of compiling a list of all of those disclosures.
So they'll just go ahead and release the information to the public.
And to both presiding officers of both bodies of the legislature.
Okay.
Section 6 adds public members to the prohibition of disclosing confidential information. Section 7 deals with an issue of charity events. It was really unclear the way the statute was written originally that charity tickets also include charity event gifts that include gifts from raffle drawings, or for instance the Fahrenkamp classic each year, the first place winners each receive a golf bag, which is a gift of value. Under current law, it's not necessarily clear that those are covered. The other thing that this section does, and another section in Section 9, is we're trying to clarify that anyone can contribute a gift to a legislator or legislative staffer in a charity event that has been sanctioned by the Legis Council. Lobbyists can contribute up to $250. It's reportable, and they cannot exceed that amount under any circumstances. A non-lobbyist could contribute beyond that $250, but that amount would have to be reported also.
Yeah, Senator Meyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, Reneva. And Senator Coghill, learning, this is very informative, and I appreciate you doing this and going through this kind of detail. But just makes me think, like tonight, for example, we have the Thanksgiving in March event, a sanctioned event. And if I recall, if you buy a pie, then your name automatically gets thrown in a hat for a door prize of a cruise. So I'm feeling pretty lucky today. So if my name gets pulled out of the hat and I win this cruise, that's acceptable as long as I disclose it. Is my understanding that
correctly?
Through
the chair, that is correct, Senator Meyer.
Very good. Thank you. Tonight's tonight.
Section 8.
Competition.
Okay. Thank you.
And Section 8 is just housekeeping, adding that ticket or gift connected with a charity event to existing statute. We've already done Section 9. Section 10. This section accommodates people who may be required to make a disclosure under statute, but that disclosure would violate the U.S. Constitution, the state constitution, or state or federal law. This allows them an opportunity to submit a request to the committee to refrain from disclosing that part of the disclosure that is considered confidential.
Just pause right there. I've heard stories of attorneys and doctors and professionals who have patients and or clients, and their feeling is if they disclose the names of their clients, they would be violating either their duty of confidentiality, their duty of confidentiality to their client. Does this address that issue at all?
Mr. Chairman, it would, because that is a federal law under HIPAA. And they would have to request that they not disclose the information, but they do not have to disclose the information because it would be found that it would be a violation of HIPAA. Section 11 addresses volunteers and educational trainees. Under current statute, even though they are doing the same type of work that a legislative aide would do, they are not required to take ethics training. Under this change in statute, they would be required to take the training. Section 12 actually is some house cleaning for Section 13, for Section 14, where we're adding a new section dealing with alternates. Section 13 also is just adding reference to AS 2460-131, which is Section 14 and is a complete rewrite of the alternate members. Not only does it address alternate members for House and Senate members, it also addresses the State Supreme Court would now be required to appoint an alternate also. Under existing statute, they don't have that opportunity. So this would include the State Supreme Court in adding alternates to the committee. Again, Section 15 is just under the legislative ethics course requirements. It is adding the fact that legislative volunteers and educational trainees will undergo legislative ethics training. Section 16 is a request by the committee. Under current law, we have a list of people who are exempt from ethics training. The list includes security, messengers, supply, the print shop, maintenance employees. Rather than add someone to the list every time that situation comes up, because all of these people are hourly employees, we are just amending the statute to say hourly employees do not have to take the ethics training.
Could I just pause there and ask,
sure,
how do you define a volunteer? If someone spends an afternoon helping out, does that require them to undergo this course? And do you have a definition or time of hours? Or?
Mr. Chairman, there's several ways to do that. There have been volunteers that have been approved through Ledge Council. There have been volunteers that have been approved. Of course, statutorily, we have, like, your UAF interns are considered volunteers. That is statutory. Most of them are approved through Ledge Council if they're not covered under statute. And I'm sure there are cases where even the rules chairman would approve a volunteer for an office.
Mr. Chairman, I might add on that. In order for somebody to help in the office and get, say, use of a computer or use of a key to that office, you're going to have to go through the rules chairman or you're going to have to go through the legislative council. So at that point, it would be determined whether it would be a volunteer that would require the ethics training. For example, once you start using computer work and once you have access to information within that office, we feel that the proper use of that should be under the same type of rules. Even if they're only there for 10 days, they should still be aware of what they're doing. And I think they could inadvertently put their legislator in a real awkward situation if they weren't aware of what the rules are. And the Ethics Committee does have a way of doing that online.
I know one of the issues, I know this issue's come up before, I agree, it's, you know, we certainly want to have everyone as well-trained as possible. I know one of the issues that has come up is occasionally you'll have staff members who are out, and then you'll have someone fill in for a day or two. And what's your analysis on that?
Mr. Chairman, would that person be on payroll?
I know this is something that happens pretty regularly in the building.
Mr. Chairman, if the person is on payroll, they are considered a legislative employee and they have to comply with the training.
Thank you.
Section 17 defines state travel because we're using that term when we're talking about partisan activities during state travel. Means travel with transportation or overnight lodging that is provided or paid for with state sources. And then Section 18 is the repeal of AS 246130N, which is the old statute that deals with the alternates that is replaced by AS 246131, which starts on page 12 and runs to line 6 on page 14. Mr. Chairman, that is the extent of the legislation. I might also, just for those who read the original statute, I did also include a summary of the actual changes that occurred between the original bill and the CS that's before you.
Okay. Mr. Chairman,
yes,
in the packet that you folks got in your committee, we did give you the NCSL, National Conference of State Legislators, links to ethics laws in the state. I can tell you, we are on the front end of defining these things. Many of the issues we're dealing with are because of some of the issues we went through over the last 10 years on legislators who did act or didn't act properly. The other thing is, the state travel issue is not as big an issue in other states, primarily because most of them can drive to their state capital and go home by just getting in a car and within an hour or so getting home. So it we have not found that much with regard to state travel in various other states. And then you have in there, you have all of the minutes from the Ethics Committee referenced in your sectional that actually show the discussion on state travel issues, which is probably the toughest question to answer. So we tried to give you parameters to begin that discussion with by calling it a working day, 8 to 5, so that most people know that during those times, partisan activity is prohibited.
Okay, thank you. Questions from the committee? Okay, a lot to digest. If there are no questions, do you have any final comments before we close out the hearing?
Mr. Chairman, just to point out that, as Senator Coghill said, there is about five or six different advisory committee opinions in here that are cross-referenced on your sectional so that you can see what they're addressing. And then there are also, I wanted to put in a couple series of minutes during just 2010. That doesn't include 2008 and backwards, where the Ethics Committee has struggled with this state travel.
Okay. And I completely neglected. It looks like we have one person signed up to testify. It's Skip Cook. Skip, are you there?
I'm here. Can you hear me?
We can, yeah. If you could speak up and welcome to the committee, put yourself on the record and give us your testimony.
Yes, I'm Skip Cook from Fairbanks. I'm the current chair of the Legislative Ethics Committee. I've served on the committee since the late 90s, so I have been through all the discussions on state travel, or well, most of them. There may have been some in the early 90s before I was on the committee. I just had two areas of the bill to comment on. Joyce Anderson, our administrator, is also online, and she may, if there are technical questions, she may be more up on some of those than I am. But I did want to comment on the state travel. That has long been a subject of discussion in the committee. The committee has taken the position that the statute is quite clear. As Senator Coghill said, the law puts us in a tough place. Well, the law is clear that there is no campaigning or partisan political activity allowed while a person is on state travel. The committee has no position on what the law should be. Our only position is on what the law is, and our position is that the law currently prohibits that. There have been many discussions within and without the committee about how that might be changed. We don't have a position on that as a committee. Our job is to interpret the law and to try to apply the law as it's written. Understandably, the legislature has been reluctant over the years to change that law because of public possible public reaction to the change. But nonetheless, the position of the committee is that the legislature passed the law, the legislature must amend the law. We don't do that. The other thing I'd like to comment on is the structure of the committee and the use of alternates. The committee is structured so that there are 5 public members and 4 legislative members. I believe that was done so that there was public input on the whole question of legislative ethics. Over the years, there's been a little bit of a disadvantage to the public side of the committee in that we have not had any provision for alternates. If a public member, and we're all busy people, and sometimes the matters prohibit us from attending a meeting, but there's been no provision for an alternate, I'm just saying public member, where there has been a longstanding provision for alternates for the legislative members. And so there is a suggestion that be changed so that the, I guess it's the Supreme Court, that Chief Justice could appoint an alternate member for the public members if the member's not able to be there. That would just be one, as opposed to the way it is with the legislature. Each legislator has an alternate, so it's still a little different from the current law, but it would be better. I guess there's been a change in this draft that goes a little further and allows that if the legislative alternate or legislative member and the alternate, neither one can attend, then at the last minute there could be an appointment of somebody else to attend by the president of the Senate or the speaker of the House. Now that, again, if you're not going to do something so that, you know, there is no provision that we have any more than alternate appointed, and if that alternate couldn't attend and a public member couldn't attend, there's nobody to, at the last minute, appoint anybody there. Frankly, I think, and I know our administrator feels, that it's going a little too far to say we have a member and an alternate, and then at the last minute there could be somebody else appointed. That doesn't work very well with committee procedures, where we have to get materials out in advance to the people who are going to participate in the meeting and have them have a chance to study it, and so on. It's sometimes even difficult now with the alternates to get them up to speed. But to have, you know, the member not be able to attend, the alternate not be able to attend, and suddenly, you know, there's a provision for somebody else to attend, I believe, unless you're going to do that for both the public members and the legislative members, it isn't fair, and operatively, it is going to make things very difficult for our administration. And I would invite you to have Joyce comment further on that if she has anything to add. Those are probably the two areas of the bill that I just wanted to comment on, and otherwise I'll turn it back to the committee and possibly input from Joyce.
Yep, thank you for your thank you for your testimony. Are there questions? Okay, see, now Joyce, are you online?
Yes, I am, Mr. Chair.
Welcome to the committee. Do you have any testimony you wanted to give, Joyce?
Mr. Chair, Joyce Anderson, Administrator for the Select Committee on Legislative Ethics. I would agree with the comments made by Senator Coghill as well as by Raineva Moss regarding the bill, that it definitely is a lot of areas that the Ethics Committee has recommended. I also agree with the comments of Skip Cook, who is the chair of the committee. And so at this point, I would be available to answer any questions or provide any background information for any of the issues.
Okay. Any questions by the committee? I think the committee is pondering the bill. I see none. Is there anyone else online wanting to testify? Okay, hearing none. Anyone else in the room wanting to testify? Seeing none, close public testimony. Okay, it's a pretty dense bill. We're going to set it aside for now. And if members have questions or proposed amendments, if you could get them to my office as soon as possible. Joyce Anderson is a great resource, or I know she's happy to talk to people about the way that things have worked over the years if anyone has questions. And with that, we're going to close out the meeting and adjourn.